I want to introduce Carol McManus, who's going to talk to us today on pain and mindfulness, I believe.
Thank you.
Or anything
yeah,
else
that's
you
my
want
plan.
To talk about. And Carol's been at Swedish for a long time now.
I think about 14 years.
14 years, and has taught mindfulness courses, caregiver wellness courses. She's a physical therapist, and so she's totally qualified.
So
very thankful that she could come.
Well, I'm really happy to be here, and I just put together an outline of what I'm going to talk about, and I thought I'd start off. I'll just say a little bit about how I got into all of this, and then my plan is to talk a little bit about pain, because I think to understand how mindfulness might affect pain, it's good to have just a little understanding about pain, and then I'll just talk a little bit about the research in mindfulness and pain, and then just kind of my own experience and how I work with patients. So actually, one of the things I'd love, since we're kind of a small group, I would love for people, if you could just share your name and then, you know, sort of what your role is here, whether you're, I don't know, and what your position is here, just so I have a sense of who you are and even if you have anything specific you'd like to learn from me. So.
Hi, my name is Vicki Corn, and I am in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine, and I'm an advisor. I work with students in a couple of different programs.
Thank you. I'm Beth Rollinger. I'm an occupational therapist with the Occupational Therapy Curriculum.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I'm Neil Kumar, I'm director of mental health at Hall Health Student Health Center.
I'm Stacey Lee, I'm a physical therapist.
Oh, great. I'm Vicki T.
I'm Mary Bolton, and I'm a guest.
Great, you're welcome.
My name is Susan McKay, and I'm with the Rest of Champions.
I'm Kurt O'Brien, Organization Development and Training for UW Medicine.
Rick Berger, I'm a urologist, but I've been dry for 3 months.
I'm retired.
Hillary Light, I'm a nurse practitioner. I work in the headache clinic with Sylvia Lucas.
And we've had it.
So yeah. That's where we've interacted.
This is a handout.
Yeah. But I also took the mindfulness course for providers that Dr. Berger is involved with and found it absolutely astonishing.
How wonderful.
New to mindfulness practice. I'm a beginner, as they put it. But I'm a real believer now, so I look forward to using it more with patients.
Great.
I'm Jan Feit. I'm a clinical psychologist. I took Rick's class also. Really loved it. I'm his biggest cheerleader. I'm teaching a mind-body skills class for medical students here.
Great.
I'm volunteering to do that, and it's been a dream. It's been wonderful. I'm really enjoying it.
I realize I need my glasses.
I'm Marcia Usui, a researcher in dermatology, just interested in mindfulness.
Great. Well, welcome. So when I started practicing PT, one of the things that was very obvious to me was that people who had high levels of stress and really complicated lives had slower rates of healing or more complicated healing than other people. And so that got me interested in the mind-body relationship. Kind of about the same time, this was in the early 80s, I also was a stressed out wreck. I'd finished graduate school and took my first job and moved, and I sustained a back injury. And it was very interesting to me that no one in the course of my recovery process ever asked me, was I under stress at the time of the injury? But back then, you know, you were put on bed rest, which is a real taboo now. And when I was on bed rest, you know, you're just stuck there. You're doing nothing. And I just suddenly realized, God, there must be a better way to live than the way I was doing it, because it just seemed like I was on a downward ride here. So that's when I started. Someone said, just in passing, oh, why don't you go to Joel and Michelle Levy? There are some meditation teachers here in town. And I just took to it like a fish to water. It just seemed to make the most sense of anything I had ever heard about life itself, this idea that you could rest your attention in the present moment and that you had a capacity of attention that was big enough for the whole of the human experience, all its joys, all its sorrows, losses and gains. And you could actually do so with a kind heart, with an openness and a compassion toward yourself and your experience. And, I mean, that just that whole idea just blew me out of the water. It was so new, and just like, I felt like I'd been really thirsty, and somebody finally gave me a drink of water at that level. So I actually went back and got a master's degree in psychology, thinking I'd become a counselor for people with chronic or life-threatening illnesses. But I somehow didn't. I stayed within the umbrella of PT and then read the Kabat-Zinn book sometime in the mid-90s and had in my own practice as a physical therapist been integrating mindfulness principles in my individual patient care. So I found that book and I thought, wow, this looks great. And I'm one of those people who just jumps in and tries things. So having no, quote, formal training, I just started teaching based on my years of experience in both meditation and in patient care. So a large part of my practice now, so I do work at Swedish and I do individual relaxation training with patients, and then I teach the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. And I would say the majority of my patients, both individually and in our groups, are people with chronic pain. And, you know, one of the things that I think, boy, the information around pain and what happens with pain has just been exploding in the last, you know, 5 years. So I just want to highlight briefly just a few things about pain that might help you then understand how mindfulness might influence pain. So one, I love the metaphor that Clifford Wolf, I have on the back of the sheet is a whole bunch of articles. So anything I refer to, there's just a few articles there that from the medical literature that that are covering what I'm going to be saying, but I'll be saying things pretty briefly here. But anyway, he's got this great metaphor of pain being like a fire alarm system. So, you know, nociceptive pain is, you know, that hot burner pain. That's like the fire alarm. It takes a really intense stimulus to get the alarm to go off. With inflammatory pain, the metaphor would be now you have this fire alarm that goes off with just warm temperatures. It doesn't take as much stimulus to get the thing activated. He calls it pathological pain, but I use with patients prolonged sensitivity pain. It's like a false alarm. Now you have an alarm system that goes off willy-nilly, that it doesn't take any kind of stimulus. It can spontaneously activate. It can activate with even the slightest bit of stimulus. And so in a lot of chronic pain conditions, this can be one of the contributing factors, is now this nervous system has become very sensitive and easily activated. And the sensitization, many of you may know, it occurs. Are you all familiar with all of this, what I'm talking about, pain? Yes? No? Yes, okay. Okay, great. I'll just skip to stress-induced hyperalgesia, which I've been really interested in. So we've long known that there's stress-induced analgesia, and now researchers are looking at the mechanisms for stress-induced hyperalgesia. And it looks like there are peripheral mechanisms as well as central mechanisms. So if you put, one of the studies that I found really interesting was they placed rats on little platforms surrounded by water, and then they had the control group not surrounded by water. And they did that for an hour a day for 10 consecutive days. And then they looked at the nociceptor function. And there was a 34% decrease in the threshold needed to get the nociceptor to activate in the stressed animals. The stressed animals sent near almost twice as many action potentials for the same stimulus, and the conduction velocity was 67% faster. So stress, so we know there's, inflammation can create this hyperalgesia, so the research is also showing that stress can play a role in hyperalgesia. And the mechanisms both can be peripheral, that epinephrine plays a role in increasing the excitability of the peripheral nociceptors. And also something I find very interesting is it also can activate the descending pathway to modulate the input in the dorsal horn. So the descending pathway gets modulated to inhibit the input in the dorsal horn. So there's a couple of studies that look at that as well. So let's see, anything else? Oh, yeah, and then the brain and pain. Well, of course, that's really a whole complicated subject in and of itself. But one of the things that I find interesting is that when the brain activates in pain, one of the main components of that activation is an assessment of the threat value of what's happening. So that pain activation is not isolated to pain alone, but that there's the somatosensory component, plus then this assessment of the threat. And then how the brain activates can also modulate the descending pathway. And things that influence that modulation include like sense of control, catastrophic thinking, expectation and anticipation. So I think, you know, when we work with pain, it's just so challenging because there are so many areas where things are happening. And this is why treating chronic pain patients, there's rarely this magic bullet that this solves the problem. Because the problem, I think, can be in the periphery, it can be at the spinal cord level, it can be at the brain, and a combination of all of the above. So, that said, I think mindfulness has such a valuable role for these patients because what it enables people to do is to observe the physical sensation of pain and then their reaction to that sensation. And their reaction comprising their body's reaction, their self-talk, their emotional reaction. So they can just observe this entire landscape. And that in of itself is such a liberating thing for people to actually have the direct experience that you're not your pain. You know, that this is something you're experiencing. But there's a level of awareness that is not the pain itself. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think, especially with fibromyalgia, when they are... you know, that they're living with pain, dealing with it day in and day out, they make the mistake of identifying themselves with the pain. I'm sure anyone who's worked with that population sees that they say they've identified with the pain. And so this gives them a direct experience that's a misperception. This is something they're experiencing, but it's not who they are. And even in just saying that to patients, you know, I've just had people tear up at the reflection back to them that they are not pain. That's not who they are. They're a whole human being experiencing this situation. And then, of course, out of that direct observation of the present moment, you know, other kinds of choices can arise. And, you know, the ability to, you know, breathe deeply or to relax or to just observe the storyline. So here's a sensation, here's a storyline about the sensation. There are two different things. Oh, here's my emotional reaction. Here's a sensation. And here's my emotional reaction. And then again, people can begin to make some shifts. Does anybody have any questions on anything I've said? I just start opening my mouth and can just talk about this subject at length. So, but I'm happy, this is such a small group, I'm happy to be informal. Any questions on anything I've said so far? Yeah.
I have one. I've worked a lot with fibromyalgia patients and how to translate what you said into something they can understand, the desensitization, the nociception.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with how to put that in layperson's terms.
Yeah.
Could you say how you would say that to a patient so that they could understand
understand sensitization?
Yeah.
Actually, this is the thing that I've just started doing at Swedish, and I don't know that I'm ready for prime time, so that's why I didn't really talk too much about it. I've actually developed a course in pain neurophysiology for patients, and it's a two-course program. Like I said, it's still kind of a work in progress. And my best friend from high school, excuse me, is doing my art. So I really want to have this nice art because at the moment I just did Google Images. And for patient education, Google Images aren't so great. So how do I explain sensitization? I use the fire alarm metaphor a lot.
Yeah.
So and a lot of people recognize that. Oh, it's the wiring that's sensitive. And there's an interesting study that I'll sometimes quote where they looked at people who had chronic low back pain and fibromyalgia and healthy controls, and they simply pressed their thumbnail. And what they found in terms of for people to say, oh, there's an onset of an intense pain right there, just the beginning, it took less than 1 kilogram of pressure for the people with the chronic pain conditions to say, oh, that feels painful. Whereas it took closer to 3 kilograms of pressure for someone who has pain, who's a healthy control, to say they have pain. So for some reason, with less stimulation, the nervous system is translating this into pain. And one of the reasons this happens is that, so this is one of the ways I explain it to patients. So when nerves communicate with each other, one nerve just dumps chemicals into a space between the two nerves, and the other nerve will absorb those chemicals. And if the other nerve kind of absorbs enough chemicals, then it will send the signal. What happens with this sensitization process is there starts to be more and more chemicals in this space. And sometimes that can be from inflammation. And then with this side, there actually starts to be more channels or receptors for those chemicals. So now you've got more chemicals, more receptors. It's easier for this nerve to be activated. And the metaphor I use is like having a pot of boiling water. If the water's really cold, it takes a lot of heat to get that to boil. So when your nerves are not sensitive, it takes a lot of stimulation to get the nerve to activate. But with a sensitive nerve, it's like you have that water, maybe it's now up to 95 degrees. Now it's just going to take a little heat to get it to go. And when your nerves are sensitive, it just takes a little heat to get it to go. And so what a component of your healing needs to be reversing the sensitization process. So a lot of people, they focus on my knee or my heel or my back. And so just sharing this information is like, and that this is a component. I don't say this is all that's happening or whatever, but this is a component, and you want to look at how do you reverse the sensitization of the tissue. Richard, you look like you're going to ask me, puzzled. Are you going to ask me a question? Or?
Well, I was just wondering, that's peripheral sensitization.
Mm-hmm.
I get what I, but in the sort of mindfulness perspective, I think of it as something as sort of bare attention. The differentiation between bare attention and memory and fear.
Right.
Memory of the past, what happened, and fear of what's going to happen in the future. And that's a difficult concept, I think, to get across to people as well. Or do you attempt to do that?
Well, actually, now in my pain neurophysiology class, I do talk about that. And I have 3 areas of the brain. I have the prefrontal cortex, and then I have the amygdala and the hippocampus, and then I have the anterior cingulate and the insula. Mm-hmm. And I talk about when we have pain. Pain is not just the physical somatosensory input, but pain is then an outcome of this process that includes cognitive and emotional pieces. And when I talk to patients, so the question is, how do I explain sensitization? So that's how I explain sensitization. When I use mindfulness to talk about pain, I talk about, life happens in the present moment. And we have, it's so easy for the mind to go into fear and anxiety. A lot of these people have a lot of fear and anxiety. And so interesting, if you really pay attention to fear, I'm inviting people to do this exploration themselves. It's not, you don't have to believe me. But, it's often about the future. And, you know, if you really start to pay attention to your mind, you'll see how creative the mind can get about the future and how easy it is for us to feel overwhelmed when we add the unknowns of tomorrow onto what we face today. I mean, I think being a human being is a fundamentally very vulnerable experience, and anything can happen. And so it's very understandable. And so just the skill of being able to come back to the present moment and the invitation to make the most skillful choice you can in this moment. And that is the prescription for living well today and this moment. That's where your power is. And then that's also going to serve as the foundation for the future. So that's the way I describe that. I do talk about, you know, that there's one of the research studies I have there by Apicarian, who's at, I think, in Chicago. You know, one of his thoughts is that the brain actually gets into a habit of generating pain, independent of tissue damage. And, you know, the metaphor, or the example I use is, you know, I cared for my parents for quite some time while they were here, and every day at 10 o'clock I'd pick up the phone and I'd call to make sure they got out of bed and they took their medications, they were still alive. So my dad passed and my mom passed, and after my mom passed, you know, I took a couple weeks off, but then at 10 o'clock every day I was in my office and I was reaching for the phone. And it was like my nervous system, my brain was in this pattern, 10 o'clock, you know, call your mother. And it took a while to undo that habit. And so, again, this is just some of the thinking that's going on. And this I explain, you know, none of us, you know, we're all sort of explorers and we're investigators and we don't have all the answers. But this is what people are thinking, and there are some people who think the brain gets into this kind of a habit. So what you want to do is kind of experiment with breaking the habit. And another metaphor I use is like with people who have high blood pressure. Now, there's a multitude of things that can contribute to your blood pressure. And actually, some people come to me to learn to relax and to see if that helps. And some patients really helps them. They learn to relax, their blood pressure is less. Other patients, it doesn't matter. They could relax from here until, you know, the end of time, and their blood pressure is still elevated. But we don't know until we try. And I think with pain, it's similar. There are so many things that could be influencing this. It's really to your benefit to experiment, to try as much as you can, whether it's mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, exercise, massage, you know, because there's just so many different things happening. I think the thing that I'm beginning to see teaching the pain neurophysiology class and then people taking the mindfulness class is a lot of people say the combination is really helpful. I think the pain neurophysiology class is really giving people, one, an understanding of their problem, and that in of itself helps to reduce fear. And then, two, it gives them a real rationale for doing things, for taking that, being self-motivated, because they are learning that how they talk to themselves is going to influence their nervous system. It really will matter. If they exercise, it's going to influence their nervous system. It really will matter, and they know why it will matter. So it's and I think with the pain neurophysiology class, when they see the amygdala instincts and fear and anger, well, if they're just perseverating in their anger about this injury or whatever, it's understandable you'd be angry. I always love to mirror that, yeah, you know, this is no fun. And is this where you want to stay, especially given how this is going to be influencing your brain? And, you know, leave it up to them. So, yeah. Any other questions or comments? Or did that help you with how to talk to patients about... It's really complicated. I'm still, like I said, I'm a work in progress. That's why I wasn't...
Well, I think the boiling water is helpful in how the chemicals are dumped into the synapse system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think metaphor is helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, I explain to people, you know, like, okay, so I can move my ankles, no problem. Then if I sprained it, now if I tried to move it, it would really hurt. So now normal movement is triggering pain. Well, how's that happening? That's happening because the nerves have gotten sensitive. because of the stimulation, the inflammation. And with normal healing, that reverses. Another metaphor I use that's sometimes helpful for people is a sunburn. You get a sunburn. Usually you can have hot water on your shoulders. People can pat you on the back, no problem. You get that sunburn, and it's like, you don't want to have a hot shower. You don't want anybody to touch you. And again, the nerves have gotten all very sensitive because they've actually been burned, and there's a little inflammation going on. But again, that reverses. With normal healing, that will reverse. And for reasons we don't totally understand, in some chronic pain conditions, it would seem that that is not happening in the normal way. It's not reversing. And I'm beginning to think that stress is playing a role in keeping the nervous system sensitive. And this, again, when I think of how mindfulness can affect pain, if people are becoming more aware of their stress reaction and more skillful in self-regulating their stress reaction, then that's going to potentially help reduce the contribution of the stress response to their pain. And a lot of patients say their stress makes it all worse. Yeah. So,
I'm just curious how you would distinguish sort of mindfulness that you're explaining to patients from psychotherapy.
I just told somebody the differences yesterday around cognitive behavioral therapy specifically. But one of the differences that I see, actually I see two big differences, but one is that with mindfulness, you're letting the mind rest in the present moment. And you're bringing this generous acceptance to things as they are. That there's nothing you need to improve upon or change or do. Your main effort is one of just present moment attention. And now that doesn't negate making choices or changes or taking deliberate action. But the practice itself, and this very first step, is one of just that bare awareness of what is. So my experience of cognitive, so with that practice, like in you're observing your thoughts, or just thoughts. You're not needing to label them good, bad, right, or wrong. You're just noting them as thoughts. Your emotions, too. They're emotions. They're not adverse. They're a human experience you're having in this moment. So I think of psychotherapy. This is just, whatever's happening in the present moment, my sense of it is there needs to be some kind of change. Something's going on here that I need to change. I need to change my thinking. Like with cognitive behavioral therapy, you're looking at your storyline and then you're deliberately changing it. And that's not to say that those changes don't come out of mindfulness, but you're not going into it with the intention of changing anything. You're going into it with the intention of just being fully present to life. And of course, there's so many different types of therapies. I think mindfulness and therapy can go very well together. The other thing I think is hugely different is the idea of, you go see a therapist and you're often focusing on yourself and your problems. And my experience of the meditative practice is that you're continually using the practice to feel your interconnectedness with all of life. And, in the lens of the Buddhist tradition, there's really no evidence for an individual isolated self. This is kind of just a fabrication of our awareness. So rather than with the psychotherapy, it's like, my problem, I have to change this, I have to do this. I love in the practice, I always close the practice with a dedication of the merit, just acknowledging your experience in this moment and recognize, the goodness of your effort. And that goodness does not end here. But you can imagine sharing that goodness with just anyone who comes to your mind. Just imagine that goodness is just naturally flows from you. And then send that out to even a larger audience. And even with the loving kindness practice, that's another reason why I love the loving kindness practice, is it's this continual sense of interconnection. And I have to say, one of my huge surprises in doing the loving kindness meditation was with the neutral one and how that changed for me over time. When I first started doing kindness practice, you know, may you be peaceful. Are you all familiar with kindness practice? Yeah. Anyone not familiar with kindness? Loving kindness practice? Okay. So I thought neutral was so boring. It was like, I could care less about this neutral one, you know, and I would get to the neutral one, I would just be so bored. But now what it has come to do for me is to help me feel connected with everybody. You know, that whoever I choose is a neutral person, kind of is a stand-in for the, you know, most of the billions of people on the planet who I don't personally know. And so here in this one neutral, if I'm actually training and learning about how my heart can be so open to them, what I have found, and it was really, truly, honest to goodness, a surprise, I think it's helped decrease my sense of isolation in the world and my sense of kinship with everybody. So that is something that I do not see in psychotherapy, is the continual invitation to use your personal challenges in life as a doorway to your interconnectedness with everyone. And to me, it's one of the things that is so enlivening about the practice, in my experience of it over time. I just feel like that's one of the pieces that's helped me move from my stressed out, neurotic mess that I was in my 20s to shift in a way and have a little more ease in my life and peace. Yeah.
Carol, could you give us your exact verbiage or instruction that you give to a patient or a client who is in excruciating pain mm-hmm. at that moment and they don't want to be with it because it hurts too much?
Right. Okay. So, and actually, you know, I feel like I'm a little bit of I don't know, you know, I guess we all come to our own ways with dealing with things. But, you know, with mindfulness, of course, there's the invitation to look deeply into the nature of something. And with pain, we know that if you really pay attention to pain, you actually activate the descending pathway to amplify the dorsal horn. So, and I think a lot of these people amplify the activity of the dorsal horn. So I think a lot of these people aren't ready for something like that. So with somebody who's in excruciating pain, first of all, I think the most important thing is for me to not be afraid of the intensity of their pain. For me to be very calm, generous acceptance, I'm not freaking out. They can be in a pain level at 120, and I'm like taking that breath and seeing in them the part of them that is beyond the pain. The pain is still a physical sensation. And Thich Nhat Hanh used a phrase in one of the class teachings I went to that was by him. He talked about the condition within us that is non-liable to affliction. This deepest nature of our ultimate reality is non-liable to affliction. It's not possible to harm it. And this is not a concept. This is actually something that can be directly experienced. But I think as a provider, it's very helpful, you know, even if you haven't had that experience yourself, to the best of your ability, just be very calm and have an unconditional confidence in that person's capacity to deal with that moment. And I think our presence, you know, there are those things, mirror neurons, you know, how, you know, who knows? I mean, by my unconditional confidence and total peace, is that influencing their brain activation at all? I don't know. But something is conveyed to not be afraid of their pain. And then definitely just invite them to breathe. I know this is really a difficult moment for you. To be able to be seen for any of us in a moment of great distress is in and of itself comforting, because in that moment we're not alone. So to say, I realize this is very distressful for you. And what I'm going to invite you to do now is to just focus on your breathing. We know that if you focus on your pain, that can actually help to fuel that pain. If we can get you to focus someplace else, that in of itself can be a help. So let's focus on your breathing. We also know that when we're in pain, we love to hold our breath, and that also can fuel the pain. So it's going to be very helpful. I love to keep the instruction very simple. Let's just breathe into your waistband. Excuse me. So you have that feeling of, you know, your abdomen slightly rising and slightly falling. Now, as an experiment, I want you to think of your mind as being like the sky. Just kind of being willing to experiment with me. Think of your mind as being like the sky. And that you carry in your heart an ocean of love for your loved ones. So you can bring to mind those you love, maybe a child, a pet, a family member, a friend. And recognize how you carry in your heart this ocean of love that is boundless and immeasurable. And this physical sensation really can't hold a candle to that feeling in your heart. So as an experiment, note the unpleasant sensation, label it a sensation. It's one of many sensations arising in your body. It's not who you are, it's a physical sensation. And think of it as a cloud just floating in this boundless, boundless sky of your mind. Notice your breath. You know, if the pain is in the foot, I'll have them notice their left, in the right foot, I'll have them notice their left hand. Let's get your attention to the opposite side of your body, somewhat distal to the pain. Because again, you're going to be kind of influencing how the brain is activated just by doing that. And again, I'll just have them breathe if they're lying on the treatment table. I'm just going to invite you to notice the feeling of your body resting against the table. It might feel like you could sink into the table, so here's a very unpleasant sensation. And then you can notice your breathing. You can let your awareness be with your breath. You can have that feeling of sinking into the table. You can think of your mind like the sky, the pain like a cloud, this ocean of love in your heart. And so I try to keep coaching in a very calm, you know, no problem voice and see what happens. And if they say, oh, it's really hard, okay, then let's just stay with your breath and yes, this is really hard. You know, sometimes I know for myself when the fire's been real high under the frying pan in my life to think of other people are just like me in this moment experiencing this. And so just recognize, you know, you're here surrounded by all these people trying to be helpful, and also there are a lot of other people like you in this building right now who are dealing with complicated medical conditions that are really uncomfortable. Can you imagine just sending yourself some compassion? Sometimes being a human being is really, really hard. There is no doubt about it. So compassion is a good medicine for ourselves. Can you send yourself compassion? And can you think of sending that compassion to everyone else who's on this floor? So again, trying to bring in that, because when we just focus on ourselves, there's this tendency to get so small. And a lot of people really like this, because a lot of people with pain, as you know, feel very isolated. They feel it, and that's another thing about the mindfulness in the class as opposed to working with me individually. And even the pain puzzle class, that's what I'm calling it, the pain puzzle. Just this idea that, oh, there are other people like me, makes a big difference. So is that helpful? That's how I would actually, you know, if you were sitting in front of me just going, that's what I would go for. And if, you know, if it doesn't work, I just keep breathing, coming back to those metaphors and just, yeah, it's you know, and it's one thing to have, you know, like myself, 20 years or plus of meditation practice and something really challenging happens and then I've got all these, you know, a pocket full of skills to use. But it's another thing when, you know, I think people are learning this right in the midst of the fire being really hot. Wow. I just have a lot of respect for people who, I mean, this human journey, ooh, it's just, that's true some days. So even when you have all those tools in your pockets, it still can get really tough. Yeah. Any other questions? Well, you know, I have to say it's really fun for me just to share what I've learned with you, because I have been doing this. This has been the focus of my career, and I'm just really enjoying myself telling you what things I've learned in the hope that they might help you with your patients. Because, you know, you pick up little things, you know, over the years and try to bring it all together. The research, a lot of the research on mindfulness is done with really experienced meditators, you know, the research with brain activation. And so one of the things that's pretty consistent with the research on meditators is that it takes actually more stimulus for meditators to say they have pain. So they have a lower sensitivity to pain. And also they are likely to rate pain as less unpleasant. You know, certain stimulus, they will perceive it as not as you know, distressing. And when you looked at the brain activation, there's an article here that I quoted just under meditation. I just have to remember what it is. So there was reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala, and the hippocampus, and then increased activity in the insula, the anterior cingulate cortex, and interestingly enough to me, the thalamus. And so you can, to me, I can understand that, you know, the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala, you're not as fearful, you're not going to get the amygdala activated. Maybe you're not even activating your executive kind of, you know, effort around this. It's just a sensation. You're not needing to get engaged in processing it at an executive level compared to non-meditators. And then increased activity in the insula and anterior cingulate cortex. That's all interesting. And reduced functional connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex. So basically what these researchers concluded is that, yes, meditators just are not getting as engaged with the input. There's no need to get too excited about it. So there's just not as much going on in that terms of that connection. In, you know, the clinical studies on this, there's not a lot of good research, and I actually just quote, and you've got the reference to one review article that was recently published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, doing a systematic review of mindfulness and pain. And I have to say I'm in agreement. The research in mindfulness and pain, the studies, either they don't have a control group, they're not randomized, they follow up with the intervention group, they don't follow up with the control group, and they're just not robust enough to make a lot of conclusion about them. But that said, and again, it's interesting. I think this would really vary on the teacher. I think because of my understanding of pain and pain activation, when I work with patients with pain, I do teach this idea first that your mind is like a camera lens, that you can go into wide-angle lens and you can go into zoom lens. You can look at, you know, your thumbnail and you can look at the Olympic Peninsula. And this is the capacity of your mind. So I think these folks are so used to looking, you know, their attention is so drawn to their pain that I do not want to have them, even with mindfulness, look, go right into their pain first. So I teach these folks to choose the wide-angle lens, to realize, oh, it's a physical sensation. And even I emphasize that the language, sensation. Because if we use language that's related to pain, that's going to influence our brain activation. If we use more neutral language, that's going to influence our brain activation. So I instruct my patients to go into a wide-angle lens first, and then to realize once they get the sense of, you know, they're starting to understand their mind, how the thoughts arise, what physical sensations are like, what feelings are like. Once they get that stability of mind, then the invitation to ask, well, what is this sensation anyway? So that's just how I go at it, and I can't speak for other teachers. I've actually never had this conversation with other teachers, but maybe I will when I go back to UMass and talk to people about it. But to me, that just makes sense. And also the person then has a sense of control, and that's, again, influencing their brain activation and their descending pathway. And so,
just having thoughts about when you gave the example of a person in pain, you were kind of talking about a good way to start working with them. And that's, I'm imagining this person who has no experience necessarily with meditation at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're suddenly in the hospital with some problem. Mm-hmm. And I work with newly diagnosed leukemia patients.
Mm-hmm.
The stress that's in there, you know, would be I would really like to be able to introduce it to them.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't have like, let's go to the mindfulness stress reduction group, like, you know, and so I'm going to see them. And so thinking about to a person who's new to this, who has never even considered it, you know, some suggestions about how to introduce this to folks. As a help, something that you can help them explore more and that you think could be helpful.
Right.
If they're interested.
I guess one of the ways I would introduce it is just, you know, it's understandable this is a really stressful situation, and one of the things that happens when we're under a lot of stress is our breathing changes. So one of the things that I can help you with is just an ability to observe your breath in a way that will deliberately calm your nervous system. And so it's about just letting your mind rest with your breathing. And it's not just about letting your mind rest with your breath, but it's actually how you rest your attention with your breathing. And I wouldn't even use the word mindfulness if they're not into it. But as you observe your breath, you know, just notice the sensations of breathing in, breathing out. I love the verbal cue, breathe into your waistband. Keep it nice and simple. And that it's just true that in any moment of life, some of our experience might be pleasant, some might be unpleasant, some might be neutral. This is just the way it is if you get a human body. So I'm just going to invite you to notice your breathing and maybe think of your mind as being like a great riverbed, a great riverbed of stability. And you have this river of life moving through you in this moment. And so your awareness is very stable, like a great riverbed. And just noticing your breath helps with that stability. And then to listen to your breath with a basic goodwill and basic kindness. That very often we forget to be kind to ourselves when we're in a challenging circumstance. The same kindness that you would generously give to somebody else in this moment, a loved one, a friend. As you listen to yourself, can you bring that same kindness that you would generously give to someone else in this moment? Just bring that kindness to yourself, because kindness and compassion will also help calm your nervous system. If you can listen to yourself in a kind and friendly way. And so I would just guess I would go from through the breath. And also, you know, it's easy in a situation like you're in to go into fear and worry about the future and to realize that's normal. And these feelings are going to come and go. And for you to be able to be with your breath, and this is like a storm moving through. It's not easy. Actually, I'm a cancer survivor, breast cancer survivor. And, you know, I had all these years of practice. Meditate on your own end of life. You know, dump. Picture yourself dead and your corpse, you know, dissolving in front of your eyes. So I've done all that, and I'll tell you, it's nothing like getting that phone call and saying, well, you have breast cancer. It's like the floor falls out. And the practice that I found most helpful was the kindness meditation practice. I just found that to be really helpful, you know, to have a few phrases. Because, again, the tendency of the mind to go towards fear. And here's a practice that's going towards love. And again, a practice that's going towards being interconnected. So I found it very helpful to do kindness for myself, kindness for other providers, my healthcare team. That really made me feel good, because all these people were, you know, the thing was amazing, all these people, like, I never knew these people before. I mean, I maybe got a couple of referrals from some of them, but now they were like saving my life. I mean, it was just an amazing experience that these total strangers were suddenly so caring. It was just a really interesting experience to be on the other side. So this idea that I could offer them goodwill helped me to feel better. So I often will teach kindness meditation. And one of the phrases that, and of course I encourage people to use any phrases they want, but may I be free of distress and the causes of distress. So life has really unpleasant things happen, and then you know, can we learn to respond with wisdom, with stability, with skill, you know, so to be free of distress and the causes of distress. May I dwell in love and compassion. And to really, can you actually generate a little of that feeling in your body? Just the feeling of love and the feeling of compassion. And, you know, I encourage people to choose any words they want, but yeah. But it is, you know, it isn't easy. But again, I think having confidence in people, and for some reason, this is this person's journey. You know, we don't understand how or why, but to have the confidence that they can do their journey. And we just...
A practical question.
Yeah.
How do you bill for your services? Do you bill as a physical therapist?
I do bill as a physical therapist, and not for the mindfulness-based stress reduction class. That's an out-of-pocket expense. And I just think it's such it's just a tragedy because, you know, of all the programs, I mean, to teach people skills to help themselves, that we can't cover. But, you know, we'll cover an injection or whatever. But anyway, not to mention, I mean, that's all can be skillful, but it can be very skillful to teach this to people. Individually, I do bill it as a physical therapy procedure, and I'm basically teaching therapeutic exercise, in my opinion. I'm teaching and neuromuscular reeducation, you know, diaphragmatic breathing, body awareness. I do teach progressive relaxation, and I instruct that there's a difference between progressive relaxation and mindfulness. Mindfulness is like, yeah, it's okay, the present moment, just as it is. With relaxation exercises, you're trying to get your body to relax. You have a preconceived agenda. I'm going to relax. And so just know that difference. But, yeah, so I bill it as a physical therapy procedure. And when I work with individually, I see people maybe 4 to 6 one-hour training sessions. People, I basically train them. And they get it, and they don't need me. Any other questions?
Do you give them some sort of DVD or CD for guided meditation?
Yeah, I do. Actually, one of the things I do, I don't know that I have... No, I'm not here to promote my CDs. I actually
have CDs.
As a matter of, you know, I was hoping... I had some little download cards, and I didn't... Oh, do I have them? Oh, I actually have some. I was hoping I had my meditation download cards, but I was looking for them and I didn't. It's really challenging for me to be honest because I actually do. I make relaxation CDs, but I don't feel like telling my patients to go buy my CDs. I'm just not a businesswoman. I often give them away. But anyway, so I've actually made some. So you can get them at iTunes. You can get them at Amazon. You can get them at CD Baby. And CD Baby, you can get these download cards. And I actually have download cards for the progressive relaxation. So if anybody would like a guided progressive relaxation, I can leave those here. You can pick one up. But yeah, and so like for a home program, the things that I encourage patients like to take a routine activity and experiment with doing it in a mindful way, in a relaxed way. So, for example, when I used to write my chart notes when I first started into all this, I noticed, oh, my God, you know, every muscle, my toes were tense as I was back in the days before computers, you know, writing my chart notes. So my practice was how calm can I be when I wrote my chart note? And it was a revelation. And so now, you know, when I wash my hands, washing my hands, that's all that's happening for me. It's just, and it's such a gift, I think, in the middle of the day to just... Feel that warm water, notice my breath, try to tap into a kind of ease in that moment. So I encourage people to try to find a routine activity that they can do in a calm manner. I give people these little breathe stickers. That's what I was looking for. But they're just little gold stickers that say breathe on them. I have CK Graphics make them up for me. And I have them put them any place where they catch your eye, the dashboard of a car, clipboard, telephone. They just remind you to breathe. I usually do, you know, working individually with people, I can get to know, to know the person, like, oh, they've got this person they work with who really just gets them all wound up. Actually, I was working with a lawyer who said, you know, when she's on the phone with these clients, we're all upset, she does family law. So again, okay, so as an experiment, when you're on that phone, just notice your breathing. So there's a situation, here's this person on the other line is very upset, and then there's your reaction to that person. So if I know their circumstance that stresses them out, we can kind of troubleshoot. Okay, so how can you do this with that? And then I do encourage people to take, you know, anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes and do some kind of, and it depends, relaxation or meditation. Some people really want to learn to relax, and some people are coming to see me because they're a little more interested in the mindfulness. Any other questions? You want to take a couple of minutes to meditate while you're here? Okay. So just invite people to come home to your breath and the present moment. As you breathe in, just noticing the feeling and sensation in your body of breathing in. As you breathe out, just noticing the feeling and sensation of breathing out. It's not unlike the very calm, very peaceful rhythm of ocean waves meeting the shoreline. Just aware of the in-breath and aware of the out-breath. And I do think it's just a wonder how the mind can drop below the world of words and language, ideas and concepts, to rest directly with the felt sense in your body of the breath. It's the direct experience of the inhalation and exhalation, moment to moment. No matter's neither created nor destroyed, so as you rest with your breath, you're resting with the recycled stuff of the stars, directly with the mystery of life itself as it is expressing itself in this moment through you. And as we all know that any moment could be an agreeable one, it could be a disagreeable one, it could be a neutral one. So I'm just going to invite you to, you know, whatever your experience may be, cultivating a quality of stability and acceptance for yourself, your experience, just as you are. And as you observe your breath and your experience, also doing so with a fundamental goodwill and kindness. And listening in an open-hearted and friendly manner, just as you might listen to a patient or a loved one. And experiment with listening as if for the very first time, being willing to be a beginner, to not know, and when your mind wanders, no big deal, just noting a thought like a mere cloud in the sky. And then gently and deliberately returning your attention to your breath and your present moment experience, just as you are. Acknowledging the goodness of your efforts and our time together. And you can dedicate that goodness to your own well-being. May this time we've spent together and this brief practice really nourish you and benefit you. So if you can just breathe in that goodness. And know that this goodness doesn't end here, but just will flow naturally out you can imagine dedicating the merit of your practice to the benefit of the other people in this room. May we all benefit by each other's presence and participation today and our practice. And then you can extend that merit out to, you know, anyone who comes to your heart and mind, imagining them too touched and nourished. And then ultimately to all beings in all directions. May all beings benefit by this practice and our time together. And if I had a little bell, I would ding it, but I didn't bring one, so I'll just invite you to bring your attention back to the room. You have my email on that handout. I also have a couple of flyers here, one on the mindfulness class. We're actually kind of down to our last flyers, but I brought what I could. And then a flyer on my individual work at Swedish and some direct download cards if you're interested in that. So I'm happy to be available for questions if people need to could stay and ask a couple more questions, or you can always email me and get in touch with me.
You're welcome.
Oh, I didn't even read the story from a patient. Oh, well, that's okay.
Get one of the handouts.
Was that? Oh, yeah, that's the basic handout. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, you're welcome. I'm so excited to have another PT here. You know, I'm going to be doing the state conference in 2013.
Oh, you are? Actually, one of my colleagues upstairs is also doing a bariatric thing. I'm doing spring or fall.
You know, I don't remember. It's the one doing the one that's in Spokane or something.
I think that's spring.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be great.
Okay, great.
I'm going to end up going to that.
Oh,
maybe I'll just send it through.
Yeah.
I've already seen it.